This is a KNX in-depth special. Mayor Karen Bass, lessons learned. Here's Chief Correspondent Charles Feldman.
And we welcome back, as always, we're pleased to have with us on KNX In Depth, LA Mayor Karen Bass. Mayor, thank you for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on.
So let me start first with crime, only because these are some of the latest figures
yes.
that came out of a meeting just the other day with the police commission and the interim police chief, mm-hmm. Dominic Choi. And the numbers are, I'm sure, disturbing to Angelenos.
Sure.
They would just be disturbing, I think, to anyone, really. But let's see if we can put it into context and if you think there are any solutions to it. Violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
Year to date, so this is from March of 2023 to now, up 2.9%. Robberies up 9.5%. More frightening, I think, to some, homicides up 28.1%, although, I should add, down from a similar period back in 2022. So compared to then, it's actually down 6.4%.
Mm-hmm.
But the trend obviously is not a good one. Now, I know we have an interim police mm-hmm. chief, and we'll get into in a minute the search for a permanent chief. But what can you tell Angelenos who hear these numbers, and it supports their view, or at least the view of many here, that it has become a very unsafe city in which to live and work?
Well, you know, I definitely want to delve into those numbers because before Chief Moore left, we did a report, or he did a report, I was with him, about crime statistics from 2023, and he actually reported improvements. And so I definitely am concerned about what came up at the police commission yesterday and want to delve into those numbers and make a comparison. Crime, period, I don't care which category it is, needs to be decreased without question. And so toward that end, I'm happy to say that recruitment of officers is up, needs to be a lot more. But then our Office of Community Safety, because as you know, I believe in a real comprehensive approach.
Mm-hmm.
When crime happens, you have to stop it. But also we want to invest in preventing crimes as well. Now, one statistic that Chief Moore reported on that I was very pleased was that homicides were being solved at a much higher rate. A couple of years ago, the homicide closure rate in certain areas was 50%.
Mm-hmm.
That's very troubling. And so I was happy to see an improvement there. But clearly we have much more we need to do.
All right. So of course we have an interim chief, as, mm-hmm. as you know. What can you tell us about the search for a permanent replacement for Michael Moore?
Sure. And let me just say, first off, I think we're very lucky in the city to have somebody like Dominic Choi, who was willing to step in, who does not want to be the chief. But what we were looking for was the type of leadership that would bring about stability. But during this time when we're searching for a chief, we also want to do assessments to see where the department needs to be improved, what's going well, so that when the new chief comes in, the new chief will have a series of recommendations to do. And I've been very active meeting with going to different stations and meeting with officers during roll call, in between roll call, meeting with the command staff. And we've been doing a process where we've been asking officers what they want to see in the next chief. And we want to give that information to the search team so that they incorporate the perspective of officers. We've also been going around to business organizations, community organizations, so that that search firm will have data from Angelina knows about what they want to see.
All right. So let's dive a little deeper into
sure.
that. So you mentioned first we'll take what the rank and file in
rank
the police
and file
department.
And right. command.
And command. What are they saying? What are
sure.
they? What are you hearing that they want in a new leader?
Well, you know, first and foremost, they want a chief who is going to focus on them. Focus on their well-being. I've heard things from officers that I would have never imagined hearing before.
Like?
Which is they're concerned about mental health, about the stress of the job, their well-being, feeling as though, you know, of course, they've gone through what the entire nation has gone through, which is it's not the most popular profession. So I don't know of a city in the country that is not struggling recruiting. And so that is an issue. One thing that I was really surprised by is that there is lose interest in an outside person. Now, I won't, you know, I'm not doing polls, so I can't tell you, you know, what percentage, but I will tell you that there has been sentiment raised in a number of these meetings where they say, you know what, we'd like to see somebody outside. And I would have never thought that.
Well, you know, and I have to admit that I, too, am a bit shocked by that, because we had on this very broadcast, on his last day, I think, we had Michael Moore and Dominic Choi. They were both here.
Oh, nice.
And one of the things that then Chief Moore said was that, you know, we were talking about how insular the department is, LAPD, and it always has been, and that an outsider runs the risk. It's kind of like joining a fraternity and you're not quite sure what's going to happen, right?
You'll be hazed.
And he thought that for that reason, and maybe others too, that it might be best to stick within the department and pick somebody who has come up within the ranks of the LAPD. So I am surprised, as you are, given the history of LAPD and its resistance at times to outsiders coming in, that sentiment even exists. Why? I mean, did they say why?
I was stunned. Yeah. And I will tell you that we've now been raising it when we go to different stations. Well, we've heard this. What do you feel? I would have expected a roar of no, it has to be somebody from inside. But they, you know, again, what I believe in a search process, I'm not at all opposed to for inside hiring. But I do think it's important that there be competition, that we seek the best in the country.
But why do they say the people within the LAPD
change? Yeah, and that's something else, by the way, that I wouldn't have expected from LAPD officers.
But
they're saying
they're
looking for change. They're looking for a better environment. You know, they're certainly looking for better working conditions. One thing that I have found as I've gone around the city is that a number of the stations, you know, have problems that need to be repaired, leaks and other difficulties. And so I've been trying to address that. So an improvement in their working conditions, an improvement in a concern of the top command in terms of their well-being are some of the issues that have come up. They're concerned, again, like I do believe officers around the country, and I did, you know, when I was in D.C. and I was working on the George Floyd bill, it gave me an opportunity to look at law enforcement across the nation. So I know that some of the things that they're saying in terms of community sentiment and lack of support and all is a national phenomenon. It's not an L.A. issue.
Okay, so how heavily is that going to weigh? Because at the end of the day, you have to make the decision, right? The commission will give you, what, three possibilities?
Right. Uh-huh,
and then you have to decide either one of the three or somebody else, I suppose, right? Is that sentiment that you're hearing from within the LAPD for an outside outsider? Does that weigh heavily on your decision?
No, but I do want to be clear. I'm not saying that this is what everybody felt.
No.
It was the fact that anybody felt that way. That was a surprise to me, and I think it was a surprise to you.
Yeah.
So, no. I think, you know, after gathering all of the input, I'm definitely going to look for a chief that is committed to community-based policing, that is committed to continuing the move toward reform, and also the working conditions of the officers, because I think that plays out in terms of community officer interaction. And I think policing should be consistent across neighborhoods.
Let's talk about homeless and inside safe. And for those who may not be aware, and these are the figures I have, if you have others, by all means, correct it. But California, the state, is about, I think it's 30% is the figure that I have, of all the homeless in the United States, even though as a population, we're only about 12% of the entire population of the U.S. That sounds about right to you?
It does.
Yeah.
It sounds about right.
And the last figures that I saw, there are, 2,100 people in shelters, but only about 400 in permanent homes. Is that accurate?
It might be a little more than that, but your point is well taken. And it definitely has been challenging to move people out of the motels into permanent housing. And it's been challenging for a variety of reasons. And you know that I've tried to take a comprehensive approach, which means that we got to get people off the street immediately into temporary housing. But one thing, if I've learned anything, is that temporary now needs to be quite long. And that's like between a year and a half. And the reason for that is because we have thousands of units in the pipeline But no matter what expediting I've done in terms of fast-tracking building, getting rid of red tape, it still takes months. What I don't think is acceptable is to leave people on the street while you're building buildings. And frankly, that was kind of the de facto policy, is that, you know, because we believed in housing first, we didn't focus on building a much robust system of interim housing, and we left people on the street.
The last time you were here, we were talking about permanent housing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to get a more definitive definition of permanent, because people have raised the question here in the city, what's the definition of permanent housing, and for how long do taxpayers pick up the tab?
Exactly.
What is the time period?
Let me just tell you my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, this is not what the situation is.
Right.
My opinion is permanent should mean about 2 years.
But what happens
and
after
I
2 years?
That, well, but let me just say, where I think the system has really been lacking and is my focus this year is on services. Because when you move somebody off the street, when you move them into permanent supportive housing, what type of services are you providing for that person? I mean, number one, you need to identify what happened in their lives that they wound up on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is going to be a percentage of individuals who really will need to be taken care of for the rest of their lives. And we know that's people who are profoundly mentally ill. But that's not the majority of people on the street. And so I think if you have interim housing for 2 years with very serious, robust services, people should be able to be mainstreamed. I do not think that permanent means for the rest of your life. You were homeless. And so for the rest of your life, you don't ever have to pay rent again.
Yeah.
You know, that. And when you move into permanent, by the way, you know there's different examples of that. So it might mean that your rent is subsidized. It doesn't mean that you're living completely rent-free. But I believe even when we move people off the streets and into motels, I am not satisfied at all with the services that they get there. And no doubt that's one reason why people wind up back on the street and why some people have died.
There's so much more we want to talk to Mayor Karen Bass about, and we will have that opportunity when we come back. Let me ask you something. The New York Times did a kind of a profile piece, I suppose, the other day about your program Inside Safe. And there was a follow-up today in the Times. It was sort of a debrief. And they were talking about whether, to some degree, the Inside Safe concept is more for show. And the quote in the New York Times today from Jill Cowan is, she, meaning you, has been open about the fact that it is designed in part to satisfy voters. End quote. Now, you've talked about that with me before.
I have.
But the perception could be.
Yes,
you know,
I understand.
You know where I'm going with that.
I understand.
The perception could be that how much of this was just.
It's cosmetic.
Right, for cosmetic reasons.
So maybe let me just tell you, the number one reason for this is to prevent people from dying. Because people die on the street. And so I definitely learned during a year and a half of campaigning that the number one angst that Angelenos had were street homelessness and encampments. And that you've heard me say this a million times. I could build 500,000 units of housing. As long as there were tents on the street, voters would believe nothing has been done. We are going to need to continue to go back to voters for additional resources so we can continue to house people. Voters are not going to vote for propositions if they see nothing has happened. And what I learned from talking to people over a year and a half, they've taxed themselves. This is what Angelino say. We've taxed ourselves three times. And the problem keeps getting worse. So why is what you're doing any different? So it serves multiple purposes. Getting people off the street saves lives without question. But it also, I hope, will help lift people's spirits in the city because people were so demoralized. Nothing is ever going to happen. This problem's just getting worse. My kids can't even walk to school. I can't, you know, take a walk down the street. All of that. is resolved.
And the money issue, as you know, I mean, this
Oh, boy, don't get me started.
Okay, well, I'm going to get you started. So this, of course, is still playing out in court. And it is understandable, isn't it, that we're talking about huge amounts of money, and people do want to know. They want accountability. They
want to
know.
I want to know.
So are you satisfied with the level
no.
of... So what can
let
you
me
do to change
well,
it?
So let me just explain a couple of things.
Yeah.
One... As I've described, what I've been doing since I took over is building the plane while flying it, too.
Right.
And I know a lot of reporters are concerned maybe that I'm not disclosing something and I have hidden information.
Do you?
I have no secrets.
Okay.
No. The reality is that just as we're trying to rebuild a system, we're also trying to do a better job of the data. And so at LASA, for example, LASA has a new leader. She's trying to bring about change and transform LASA just like I'm trying to bring about change on the city level. So she walks into that organization and finds that it's very difficult to get data. So she's making certain changes. So we do need to document where all the money is going. But let me just say something straight up.
Mm-hmm.
It's too expensive. Putting people in motels is not financially feasible to continue. We're spending thousands of dollars per person, per room, every month. That's why you've heard me say that we need to come up with a less expensive system of long-term interim housing. But you know what? The market has made some advances. And so, for example, Councilwoman Hernandez opened up a facility in her district called New Beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of an improvement on a tiny home. So it's larger. It has a bathroom and a kitchenette. So we're looking at something like that. I'm also looking at city lands. So we have to come up with something cheaper than motels. You cannot sustain this financially.
We talked about this, you and I, when you came back from Paris. And we want to talk about the Olympics. But I mentioned to you before we started, now you didn't bring back, and I was very disappointed, you didn't bring back croissants from
I'm so
Paris.
Sorry.
But I, on the other hand, I have a freshly baked croissant made here in L.A.,
wonderful.
You're welcome to share with me.
I come to the show and get breakfast.
Yes, absolutely.
I love it.
I mean, we like to accommodate our guests. But as I cut the croissant, which is not turning out to be as easy as I thought, tell me more about what you think you learned. You want a large piece, or I'll go right down the middle.
That looks good.
That looks good. This is
your
Thank
you. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I get breakfast.
Yeah. So what have you learned?
Well, I think it was a wake-up call
right. For
us. So we were laser-focused on how the city of Paris is coping, what they did, you know, to plan for the games. The mayor opened up her staff for us. We met with them, and I think we all came back going, oh, my goodness, we need to get on the ball. Now, that's not to say nothing has been happening. We are fortunate. We have LA 28 under the leadership of Casey Wasserman, and things have been proceeding fine. There's department heads in the city that have been working on a weekly basis. But I think what was very clear is that we need the leadership inside the city to say, this is the point person. I have a wonderful deputy mayor for international affairs, Erin Bronigen, but she's dealing with all of international affairs. So now I'm looking at what type of internal organization do we need in the city to make sure that financially we come out on top.
Well, and that raises the question that, as I'm sure you know, when cities have Olympics, you know, one of two things happen, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Either promises that were made beforehand that it's going to be a great financial benefit
right.
to whatever the city is
right.
come to fruition, or they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Are you confident that this huge investment, and I get that we, unlike some cities, we don't have to build housing and stuff like that, right?
Right.
I mean, we have that here. But are you confident that at the end of the day, when the Olympics have come and gone in their history, that the city of Los Angeles economically is going to really benefit from it?
I will say that I am confident that I am going to be laser focused on that. But to say that I'm confident today, what's going to happen at the end of 2028? No, I cannot say that. But I have the legacy of Mayor Bradley that I am determined determined to continue. But I think a lot of Angelenos don't realize that we're continuing to profit and benefit from the 84 Olympics 40 years ago.
So do you have an aim in mind about how you hope that the 28 Olympics are going to benefit the city?
I don't have specific goals right now, but clearly I will establish them, and I will establish them with LA 84 and LA 28.
Let's end on national politics. The Biden administration and President Biden is seeing an increased division within the Democratic Party, largely because of what's happening in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas, and calls for ceasefires and temporary ceasefires and prolonged ceasefires and UN, I mean, the whole thing. Do you think that President Biden and this administration is handling that situation correctly? And I ask you as the mayor of L.A. because not only are you a Democrat and a known Biden supporter.
That's right.
But of course, this city has a large population of Jews and Palestinians and Muslims. And so everything and every problem that the Middle East has in some ways are reflected here in L.A.
That's right. That's where I'm grateful that I have the foreign policy background from Congress. And, you know, I mean, the Biden administration's in an incredibly difficult position, and they are working with a Congress that is dead set on trying to produce failure. The president might want to go in one direction, but the minute the Congress, and obviously I'm talking about the Republican-led Congress, I'm not talking about my Democratic colleagues, but the minute it looks like it might be something that is positive and successful, if Trump tells them no, then the members of the cult unfortunately follow his direction.
But is the president handling the situation correctly? He's been accused of not being tough enough on an ally, Israel. Is he being too soft?
Well, I think that in some instances, he could be tougher. I had the benefit of having a conversation with him when he was here the last time, and I know that he's very, very concerned, and concerned that as this moves on, especially right now, where we're talking about what could happen in Rafah, that there be a better way to go about it. And it's going to be interesting because, you know, he's known Netanyahu for years, but clearly they seem to be in a divide right now.
Have you met Netanyahu?
Yes. I've been to Israel. I've been to Israel three times. I've met with the prime minister. I've met with the president, other leaders there.
What's your assessment of how Netanyahu's been handling it?
Well, I'm not a Netanyahu supporter, I will tell you that. but that's for the Israeli Knesset to decide. The Israeli people.
I think that bell was at the croissants already.
Oh, good. No. I'm ready for them.
As always, Mayor Karen Best, thank you so much for taking time to be with us, and we look forward to the next time.
Well, thank you. Am I going to get a treat the next time? I'll bring you one. I'll tell you that.
Deal. Wait, that's you're shaking
on it. We shook on it.
Okay, deal. Okay, thank you, man.
All right.